otherwise you can either speak up now or you might not want to, and you can definitely...
Do you whisper the name when someone...
Right, whenever you speak up, especially if it's one that'll make you look bad, I'm going to quickly whisper into the recording.
Thank you.
Which is whisper that into every comment that's made by me at this point.
I'll get back.
So, last time we discussed a basic idea that was sort of the groundwork to now move forward into perhaps making a little bit more complex, you could call it. But bear with me, it'll all be understandable, I think, God willing. But last time we discussed sort of the basic idea that every person has a very natural sense of faith. Every human being is pulled, is drawn on some very basic level within them, some youthful level, some maybe you want to call it a more naive place within yourself, but a more pure, more simple-minded, simple-hearted part of yourself, which is naturally drawn towards faith, which is naturally pulled after believing that there's something beyond this physical world, there's something more, there's something that has that gives us meaning, there's something greater, something that we can't exactly sense in scientific measurements and in sort of traditional rational thought. And that thing is what we maybe call God. And we ended last week with, after having gone through four different ways that we approach that simple faith. The first was that we just have this implanted sort of capacity for faith that lives within ourselves that God gave us. And it's sort of hard to define exactly what that is, but it's just there, and we just believe. We just believe in God, and there's nothing much more to say yet. And the second way we spoke about was through sensing something more, through sort of the weird, miraculous sounding stories that we hear all the time, and we usually just shrug our shoulders and we usually just, you know, turn a cynical face towards. But there's just so much, there's such an abundance of that type of thing going on. And we sometimes even ourselves have encounters of something that seems like just a little bit too coincidental, a little bit working out a little bit too well, a little bit too perfectly, and we sort of tap into the sense that there's something more. The third way we spoke about was through encountering nature and the beauty and being swept up in nature and in the natural world and looking at a landscape, looking at a view, a mountain, a lake, anything that just, it's just breathtaking, and you feel a sense of awe and a sense of love for something mysterious that exists and that's beyond the physical thing you're looking at. And the fourth thing we spoke about, the fourth sort of angle to look at this natural, simple faith, was the angle of meaning, that the human being is a meaning-seeking being, that we all have just this craving for a purpose in our lives. We want to know why, we want to know what are we doing this for, what's the goal, what's the purpose, what's the meaning in this. And that drive for meaning naturally brings us towards the belief that there is something that satisfies that meaning, that there is something that created us, that there is something that endows our lives with meaning and has an eventual telos, a purpose to existence, that created us with an end in mind. So those are the four very simple natural ways. And we saw at the end, we were reading some quotes from an article in Newsweek about children's faith, that children in astounding sort of statistical numbers have natural faith and even more almost profound understandings of the concept of God and the concept of sort of this transcendent being more than you would imagine and expect that they would have at these early ages. And the numbers are really just shocking, especially considering that these studies supposedly, again, I don't want to, you know, build up the case more than is honest. I don't know if this research was accurate 100%, but this is what was being argued, is that these statistics are true across cultures, and regardless of religious and parental upbringing and educational upbringing, because we have this natural capacity, this natural pull towards faith. And then the question we have to ask ourselves is that if that's all true, which I really strongly believe it is, and I think that if you take the time to search within yourself and find that more youthful, maybe simple, naive part of yourself, you'll find that you have some combination or some of these, some twist on any of these angles within yourself. If all of that is true, so then what happened? You know, what happened? Meaning, if we're honest with each other, so many of us, you know, have very strong faith, and that's really great, but many of us, at least at periods in our lives, or at least in sort of a seesaw experience of faith and going back and forth, and faith could be a little bit sporadic and a little bit intermittent, So what happens? Meaning, I speak for myself even. You know, I have questions, and I have had periods of doubt, and I've had, you know, these things happen. If we're honest with ourselves, if we're honest with each other. So what happens that when we get older, we sort of, what happened to that very simple faith? What happened to that very naive, pure, natural faith in God? Where did that go? What happened to it? So that's what I want to explore a little bit tonight. And then hopefully, if we sort of target and uncover what happened to that simple faith, we'll then be able to recapture it and rediscover it within ourselves in a more profound way. So I want to lay out a few different possible ideas as to what I think happens to that simple faith. And again, please, the floor is very much open. Please, you know, speak up at any point, questions, comments, disagreements, supports, whatever it is. I'd love to have discussions. So please speak up. So cut me off at any point. So the first thing I wanna focus on, mention, is that I think the first thing that should just be called out, to be, you know, call out the honest truth, is that there's one aspect of sort of losing that simple, naive faith is exactly because of the word I keep using, which is naive. We sort of have a sort of like an inferiority complex, or like it's sort of this high school age thing that's still like lurking inside of us till even when we get much, much older. Like, it's not cool to be so religious, you know, like, it's not cool to believe. It's not, you know, the person who speaks openly that they believe in God and that they're really into it and the meaning that brings up, it's not so cool. It doesn't win you so much popularity necessarily. I mean, I would love if that's not true, but that's my impression of society in general and many communities. And I just think this is captured very well, just very briefly. We're not going to really go into this, but I think it should just be named in the first source on this page. So in this book that we looked at a little bit at last time, God and the Philosophers, which is a compilation of different essays written by religious philosophers, and these are really amazingly top-notch philosophers in different universities who are very, very deeply religious people, and they wrote about their reflections on how they balance their life of analytical thinking with belief. And William Alston wrote in his essay, he writes the following, the first source, "I have been psyched into feeling that I was chickening out." Is after he writes that he was starting to get more religious and believe more. He writes, "I had been psyched into feeling that I was chickening out, was betraying my adult status if I sought God. I was walking one afternoon in the countryside outside Oxford, wrestling with the problem, when I suddenly said to myself, why should I allow myself to be cribbed, cabined, and confined by these Freudian ghosts? Why should I be so afraid of not being adult? What am I trying to prove? Who am I trying to impress? Whose approval am I trying to secure? Why should I hold back from opening myself to a transcendent dimension of reality, if such there be, just from fear of being branded as childish in some quarters?" And I think this really well captures and expresses the point I just wanted to very briefly and quickly point out, is that there is this sort of stigma that I think possibly holds us back from being as religious, as believing, as in love with God and with religious life as we might actually want to be inside. So just to name that. The second area of something that holds us back, I think, from living this natural faith, which is what I want to focus on more, actually, is that as children, as young adults, we have these sort of natural experiences of faith that we started with, these different ways of reaching God. But as we get older and our minds get more trained and get more mature and more analytic and more rational, and we experience more things in life, and we experience skepticism and cynicism, and perhaps we encountered philosophy in college, or we read different books, we see different things on the internet, all different things that bring questions into our minds. So the second thing I want to point out is questions. That as we get older, this simple faith starts to encounter lots and lots of questions. And the types of questions can be very different for different people. Just to throw out a few possible questions. Some people worry maybe it's just a fake out, this whole God thing. You know, who said? So of course I have this simple natural faith, but does that hold up rationally? Who says? Just the most simple question, right? I have this natural experience of faith, but maybe the whole thing's a fake out. Maybe if you have a little bit more of a scientific twist on that, so people ask the question, maybe it's just a neurological phenomenon, right? We can trace all the experiences that people claim to be transcendent and sort of mystical experiences, and we can trace that back to just phenomenons of science that go on in your brain, different neurological explanations. maybe some people ask, I know a lot of people ask these types of questions, maybe it was just my upbringing, maybe it was just the education I was given, maybe it was the religious upbringing of my school, of my parents, of my community, maybe that just implanted within me and gave me the sense that there's a God, but who said it's actually real? Who said I know that there's really a God? And then there's questions of science that many people encounter. There's all sorts of challenges that science poses to religion that contradict certain things we believe, or even just the most basic belief that science can claim to explain the whole universe and explain, you know, the Big Bang and all sorts of things of that nature. And of course, there's the question which I, you know, threw out there with great trepidation, but the question of evil and the question of bad things happening in this world, which of course throws many, many people, and understandably so. So we have all these sorts of questions. And that's the second thing that I think happens to our natural faith. And hold on to that, because I want to just throw out very, very quickly a third thing, but we're going to get back to the second. And tonight we're going to be exploring the second. Okay, so just very quickly, though, I think it's important to mention the third thing I think that happens to the natural faith is the natural faith is really nice to talk about. It's really awesome to get together, you know, on a Tuesday night in a nice home and discuss the beauty of the world and you know, my simple natural faith and my drive for meaning. And when I encounter this beautiful landscape, I'm just brought to awe and love of God and all these amazing things. And it's excuse me, it's very sweet to talk about. But how do you actually live that? And how do you make that something that actually lasts and is real in life? And I think what happens to many people, and myself included, of course, is that, you know, we have that natural drive, but then how do you actually make that your life in a real way, that it becomes concretized and it becomes lasting and not just something that is in and out in very fleeting moments of inspiration? So that's the third thing, and we're going to get back to that. What I want to focus on is the second, which is the questions. So again, just to summarize what we said so far, it might seem a little bit all over the place, but it's really very contained. The first thing that I think happens is just the stigma of growing up, and it's not cool. It's not cool. Just the high school phenomenon. And the second thing is questions. And the third thing is is sustainability and how to concretize the inspirational faith, but how to make that real. What I want to focus on is the second. And what we're going to do is my approach that I've been working on that I want to share with you and would love to hear your input is not to actually address any of the specific questions. So that might sound like, what are we here for? But I don't want to address any of the specific questions head on. I want to take a much more general approach by analyzing or sort of reframing the whole concept of asking questions and take a step back and look at where is it coming from within ourselves that we have all these questions, and should these questions be allowed to sort of infiltrate into our faith? Should these questions be given the right to come, and we have this beautiful, simple faith, and then we have this adult mind which comes with all these questions and starts marching down and infiltrating and taking over that faith? Should that be allowed to happen? Not addressing any of the specific questions, because from my experience, if you start addressing the questions, they should be addressed, and it's important, and I spend a lot of time looking into lots of these different types of questions. But the second you start spending all your time invested in the specific questions, you're just going to be running around in circles forever. Because the point into which the intellectual world has gotten is one in which there's literally just endless ways to look at anything. You can't prove anything. And even if you come to some conclusion in which you have an answer, then your faith is just really just sort of wavering and contingent on that answer. And the second you have a new question, then what happens? The whole thing, the whole edifice just, you know, topples down now. So it's very flimsy. So what I want to do is look at sort of the nature of questioning and the nature of faith and see within ourselves, should that march and that attack of questions onto our natural faith, should that be happening? And now this might sound very intellectual and very philosophical and very boring to many people, but I promise you that actually it's going to, the upshot of all this is that it's going to open up the ability for ourselves to experience ourselves, to experience life, and to experience faith in a whole new and more rich and full way, bringing out a much more full experience of all the different capacities we have. So we are going to look a little bit into an analytic, philosophical examination of something for a second, but stick with me, bear with me. The upshot will be very, very meaningful, and the upshot is going to really open up worlds for us to experience faith in a whole new way. So if anyone has any thoughts, or we'll get going. Okay, so with that very long-winded introduction, here we go. If you look at your at the sources on page one, so what I want to do first is very quickly go through a couple of examples in which we are exposed, or which we actually expose, the limits of rational thought. Okay, questions, as I'm sure we can all intuit, questions come from a part of ourselves which is a rational, analytic mind, the rational analytic part of our brain, in which we have questions and we sort of dissect things and we attack them and we analyze them, we critique them, and we want to have answers. And that part of our mind demands answers, and if there's no answer that rationally can be justified, so then the thing doesn't make sense and therefore it's not valid, and therefore it sort of gets put in the garbage, it gets put on the side, it's not worthwhile anymore. So I want to look at just a couple of examples in which we expose and show the limits and sort of the place where that part of our minds hits a wall, that it actually just doesn't make sense to function. And my point in doing this is not to bore you with philosophical ideas, but is to show that we have to open ourselves up to a more full experience of ourselves than just our rational minds. Okay, so for example, the first example I want to do is something that's called the problem of the criterion. Okay, the problem of the criterion basically goes like this. For us to be philosophical, for us to be rational beings who are thinking straight and who can engage in questions and answers, we have to have a way of testing what is true and what is false. The basic starting, the building blocks for a rational enterprise thought is the concept of truth and falsehood, true and false. We have to be able to decide and determine what is true and what is false. So now, to do that, what do we need? What do we need in order to determine what's true and false? We need a method. We need to have some sort of test. You need to have a test to be able to say, here's a belief, here's a statement, a proposition, and now let's test, is this proposition true, is this proposition false? Okay, so we need to have some sort of test. The problem is, how are we going to determine, how are we going to establish a test? This is going to get a little bit annoying. How are we going to establish a test? We have to have some data of what's true and what's false, and then based on the data that we know, X, Y, and Z are true. A, B, and C are false. So now, based on those six things that we know, some are true, some are false, let's establish a way that we can now move on to other propositions and test them, right? So we need to have some starting data to establish the test, right? But we don't have any data, because to get the data, we need to have a test, right? So we just get stuck in this endless loop, this circular regress of, we need to have a test in order to be able to know what's true and false. But to get the test, we need to have something which we know is true and false. But we can't get the thing we know is true and false until we have a test. We can't get a test until we know it's true. So we're just stuck going around there in circles. So that's just a very sort of clever, but actually it's important to realize that if you want to be fully and 100% purely logical, rational, working 100% within the analytic questioning part of your mind that cares fully for truth and falsehood from a logical perspective, from an adult way of thinking about things rationally, you actually can't even get off the ground. That's exposure number one of the limits and sort of the illusion of the rational enterprise, that you can't even get off the ground. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't engage in irrational thinking, but the point is we should realize that there's a leap of faith going on. People think that science is sort of like, that's the concrete, 100% objective thing, and religion and belief, that's a leap of faith. The point, though, is that everything is a leap of faith. There's a leap in faith, of faith involved in the most basic pursuit of truth and falsehood of rational thinking. Okay, that's example number one. Example number two.
But can't you just have a hypothesis and test it? Why can't you just decide this is what I'm going to test? Why can't you just decide that? Why does it?
So how do you know your test is a good test?
Well, if it's about faith, so it's got to be something that will be. Is good for you. It's a personal test. It's not a test for everybody.
So, okay, good. So what I'm trying to focus on now is actually not on faith, but is on the sort of the more rational, sort of scientific, you could call it, school of thought.
Well, in science, you have a hypothesis, and then you test it.
So my point is that science demands and requires a leap of faith. Science is not objective. Okay, so that's a really important statement right there. Meaning, okay, great, so I'm happy. So, sorry.
Some people used to think that if you put rags in the corner of a room, then mice might get created that way.
Okay.
If you tested it long enough, then you'd find that wasn't true, right? So what's the leap of faith, let's say, in a, some sort of scientific method?
Okay, so in science, actually, that brings us to the next example I wanted to give, which is, so the first one is really just in a more general point about the concept of proving anything, of any truth and false. But specifically within science, where the reason why your question evades the first sort of critique is because your example is something which is based on matters of fact, they would be called, in as opposed to sort of a priori ideas. But let me just try and talk in normal language for a second. So your example is something about experience. We can look at the facts on the ground. We can test something. We could go ahead and, you know, take this cup of water, and I'm not going to, but if you would spill it, is it going to hang in the air or is it going to fall down?
100% right? Of the time, I will get in trouble.
So we could actually just test that. What do you mean? What's this, you know, whole fancy schmancy circularity argument of the endless loop? We could just test it, right? Okay, so here, now this is going to sound ludicrous, but it really actually has a very important point. David Hume was a brilliant philosopher. David Hume is famous for his argument that science requires a leap of faith also, that science is actually a product of habit and experience and not rational thought. And his argument is actually very, very simple. His argument is the following. Good, you took this cup of water and you poured the water out and the water didn't suspend in midair, it fell down. So now we've established an idea of gravity, right? Who says that's going to happen next time? Who says it's going to happen next time? It happened in the past. Who says the next time I pour the water is going to fall down again? Mehechetesi. Who said? So the only way that you could argue that it will necessarily happen the next time is if you can explain to me why it must be that there's a concept of gravity. But there's no a priori, there's no objective starting point reason to assume gravity. We only know gravity based on experience, but experience only tells us about the past. So who says we can take that experience and project it in the future? Where do you get that right? Who gave you that ability to do that from an objective, logical standpoint? Who said that that's true?
You could say that the probability based on experience, the probability of our statistics is that it will probably,
suspend in midair. Right, good. But who says that those statistics say anything about the future? Maybe they're all about the past.
So if you do it 100 times it works, that 100th time...
Who says it's going to work again? Who says it's going to happen again? Unless there was any reason to assume from an internal point, meaning 1 + 1 = 2, right? So that is something that we can objectively prove. I mean, there's no other way to look at it. But there's no... If we never experienced gravity... We wouldn't assume gravity. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine because it's so built into us, and that's exactly the point. But we would never have assumed gravity, and no one who's sitting in a laboratory, if someone was sitting in a laboratory, the biggest genius in the world was sitting in a laboratory, and they never experienced gravity, they would never be able to deduce and come to the conclusion that gravity would be the logical function of the world.
I think I can give you a good example. Okay, so I teach science to 3- and 4-year-olds. So, talk about pure thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So, last Tuesday, I just did the old, vinegar and baking soda, and they were like, minds were blown out of, it was amazing their faces when you combine the two. First they did with water and talked about absorption, and then we did, and it exploded, of course, in the cup, and they had a great time. This week, I was mixing liquids and salads, and their assumption was it was going to explode again. Because that was their experience.
Exactly. There you go. So Bertrand Russell gives an example. That's perfect. Bertrand Russell gives an example. He says, imagine a chicken. Imagine a turkey. The whole year, right? The turkey, every time the owner comes out and goes to the turkey, it gets a nice meal, gets very nice treatment, and comes Thanksgiving, and the turkey's, having a happy old day, exactly. And the owner comes out, and the turkey thinks, okay, here we go, I'm going to get a nice meal, I'm going to get a nice, nice treatment. And then all of a sudden, so was the turkey justified in thinking that? So, yeah, 364 days straight, it had the same thing every single time. You turned over the cup of water, the water fell down. Every time the owner came out, the turkey got an X treatment. And then something happened. So he says that's exactly science. There's no reason that we can logically... No one's arguing we shouldn't use science. Don't get this wrong. No one is arguing that this doesn't have validity. The point is just to expose the leap of faith that is involved in the scientific method and to disillusion us from the idea that it's perfectly sound on a rational, logical level. We are that turkey before Thanksgiving when we use science. Yeah.
But this is coming from the point of view of empiricists. But there's a whole school of rationalists who actually do come up with a priori laws that.
So that's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. No one can do that. You can't do that with science. There's no rational way to predict science.
I mean, I'm not a philosopher, but I'm sure that someone like Descartes would probably argue.
So the point is that you're right, but everyone's failed. That's the point. No one has been able to. Basically, now David Hume has just been accepted as 100% right. The point is that science is purely. I mean, people have tried to come up with really brilliant ideas and ways to answer it, but no one has been able to actually fully, you know, disregard David Hume's point. Kant, as a, you know, is trying to do that, and you're right. I mean, this is arguing from prison, but that's the whole point, is that you actually can't get out of this argument. I mean, you don't have to believe me, you know, look into it yourself. But
there's different trends, but I mean, I'm just saying there are schools of thought that would say that you could come up with a priori.
So I'm saying there aren't. So we're at a standstill.
I agree with you, but I'm just saying, I mean, I think...
Well, no, so I'm saying, I've looked, you know...
Discount the experience, right? So
well, yeah.
Saying
I mean,
based
they were,
on our experience, and
I mean,
they
were
that's
always
true, but that's
at loggerheads with the right with the empiricists. I mean, they did believe that you could actually. I mean, and I know that the.
I mean, people
that
have
they would
believed.
Say,
it.
Well, how
yeah.
do you come up with these a priori laws?
Right.
You deduce them,
right.
But they kind of.
So 1 + 1 is
that.
2. Always, or how do you know the next time it's going to be you had 1?
So that's an exception to this type of thing potentially, because 1 + 1 = 2 is. I mean, this is gets, you know, very involved,
but
is actually not based on experience. 1 + 1 = 2 is just, 1 + 1 = 2.
But gravity is based on formulas, and where do those come from?
So that's, we only know formulas from experience, that's the point.
And 1 + 1 = 2 from experience?
No.
But they all...
If you were sitting in a laboratory, if you were sitting in a laboratory and you never experienced, if you never experienced two things, you would be able to know 1 + 1 = 2. If you never encountered two things in your life, you only encountered one thing your whole life, you would still be able to know 1 + 1 = 2. If you never encountered gravity, you would never be able to come up with gravity.
So you're
the formulas are all retroactive explanations. They're not a priori ideas.
So you're saying the leap of faith is sort of the confusion of probability with possibility, right? In other words, something is impossible. It has to continue to happen the way that we've experienced it. Versus probability, your example of the turkey, this is how
exactly.
the pattern that we've
right.
seen. Science is based on the experiments and, like Fanny was saying, this probability idea, right, that you test it and it seems to work again and again, but that doesn't mean that something different is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a jump when you take
exactly.
statistics or probability and you now say it cannot be another way. How do you prove that it cannot be another
right.
way?
You exactly. Can't. Right, exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly. Well said. So... So, you know, whether you like it or not, this is another angle sort of into exposing the limits of rational thought. And I want to just give you a very, very quick third one, which is memory. You know, so the question is, why are we justified to use our memory? How do we know memory is legitimate, is valid, is a valid source of information? Now, you can maybe try and guess. You can try. you can probably try and guess the question I'm about to ask now. Once you've experienced all these other annoying questions we've had until now, but is, you know, any time you're going to try and justify memory, it's going to be based on your memory. Okay, so you can't actually justify your memory, because then how do you know that your, you know, source of justification is correct? Because you have to use memory to justify memory, but how do you know you could use that memory to justify memory?
So you said earlier, did I hear you say that you said science is not objective?
Correct. Well, it's, no, I mean, I don't want to be objective. It's not objectively,
it's not subjective.
Right, so that's, I mean, that's what the question is, what do you mean by objective? It's not objectively provable. The point being that it's actually something that is generated by our experience. Science is generated by our experience. It's by habit. It's by custom. The fact that we are so habituated, so sort of just overly, experiencing the same thing over and over again, that it becomes ingrained in us that, of course, this will happen the next time.
Well, then, they take a certain thing that has happened, and then they'll prove it with some mathematical formula. right? A guy like Einstein with E equals MC right. squared.
But the thing is that the point again...
And then someone comes and disproves that.
Right. But even if someone didn't come and disprove it, the point is that when you have those mathematical formulas, all they're doing is explaining and giving interpretation to the past. But they don't have the capacity to tell you from an objective standpoint that that will be true in the future. There would be no logical flaw in the world if everything we knew about science in this very moment when I smack my hand on the table changed and never happened again. There'd be nothing wrong with that happening from any logical standpoint. That's the point. But we all assume it will. Why do we assume it will? Because of experience. Okay, but I want to move on because my point isn't actually to give a philosophy class here, which I don't know if I'm capable of. But my point is to... So my point is to bring us to the realization that there's a part of ourselves which sort of, I think, dominates ourselves, which is the place of questioning. And even if you don't question the type of things that we've been talking about until now, because that might seem like an extreme, but the point is I'm trying to paint a picture which brings out this part of ourselves that I think all of us do carry, which is the part of ourselves that questions, that analyzes, that critiques from a logical standpoint. And that part of ourselves, we need, I think, to sort of put a hold on, to take it, to pull it back a little bit. Because that's the part of ourselves, to a large degree, that starts to march down and infiltrate the simple, pure faith that we have. So the reason I wanted to do what we just did is because if I would just come and say, you know, you have this part of yourself which is analytical, which is questioning, which is smart and logical, and I just said, okay, so just put that on hold. You know, just that shouldn't get in the way of your faith. Okay, so but what gives me the right to say that? You know, why should it be put on hold? Why should it be sort of given its place, but not more than its place? Why should it not be allowed to march down onto our faith? So the reason I think it's important to do what we just did is because we should see that it's actually not all it's made out to be sometimes. It's not the be-all and end-all of everything. It's not purely sound. It's not something that is 100% consistent internally. It's something which has a very important place, but it has its limitations. And, you know, as I said last time, so I was trying to incorporate, my shtick is to incorporate Calvin and Hobbes. So if you turn to page 2, there's an amazing, amazing, amazing Calvin and Hobbes excerpt. So they're standing in this, you know, dark, starry night. And Calvin says, in the top one, "Look at all the stars. The universe just goes out forever and ever." And Hobbes says, "It kind of makes you wonder why man considers himself such a big screaming deal." And then next frame is you see them, you know, sitting inside watching TV. And Calvin says, "That's why we stay inside with our appliances." So this is, you know, this is sort of a different take on the ability to ignore the limitations of our minds. But the point being that there's sort of a certain level of humility, which I think comes into play, that we should. Approach our questions. We should approach the part of ourselves that has this analytic capacity from a humble place, to realize that it has limitations, that it's not all that it's sometimes made out to be. And what this brings us to, so whether or not you followed every part of that, but what this brings us to, and this is the important part, is that the upshot is that there's a lot more to ourselves, to our life, to our personality, to our being, than our, what we call minds. And yeah, on a scientific level, it's all part of our minds, but there's a lot more to us than our minds. There's a lot more that we can use, mechanisms, capacities, abilities within ourselves that we can use to experience ourselves, to experience other people, to experience the world, than just the sort of adult, mature, thinking brain. And that's really the upshot of this whole idea of exposing limits of science, which David Schatz, Dr. David Schatz, who we quoted last time, again, is a professor at Stern College, who Rabbi Engel told me was actually a Skarner residence here a couple of years ago, so I didn't know that last time. But he writes here, we'll read it quickly, on the bottom of page 2. "Hume was fascinated by the divorce between philosophy and practical life. In my study," he said, "I come to appreciate that I lack adequate grounds for all sorts of things I take for granted in my life. The regularity of nature, the reality of the physical world, yet when I exit, those intellectual infirmities have not the slightest influence on my belief system. A philosophical skeptic, someone who casts doubt on our grounds for these and other common beliefs, cannot live his skepticism," Hume holds. Following this, his point is that people can have lots of questions, but throughout the intellectual course of history of the world. People have had questions that they can't actually internalize. They can't actually live. You have people who question, does the world exist? Does the physical world exist as I know it? But they can't actually internalize themselves to doubt the pen that they're writing with. They're writing on a piece of paper, does the physical world exist? But they're experiencing the fact that they're writing. They can't actually internalize those questions because the part of themselves that's questioning, yes, there's a part that's questioning, but we have parts of ourselves that are much stronger, much more powerful, much more acute and potent than that questioning, skeptical part of ourselves. And then Schatz continues, even in his study, in fact, Hume isn't really a skeptic, and he makes the point that I just made. I was plagiarizing from him. He doesn't doubt he's putting pen to paper, and he doesn't wonder whether the people will abruptly pop out of existence. That nobody is really a skeptic, even while philosophizing, becomes clear if you watch what we philosophers do, not what we say. When a philosopher publishes, he has a great line here, an article called Why There Are No People, in actual title, he invites a joke. Whom does he think he's writing for? Who will he blame if he gets turned down for tenure? Hume's point, however, was probably more normative. Normative means that he's telling you what to do, as well as descriptive, not just that he's pointing something out. Hume taught us, in effect, that it is a vice to be too rational, to hold out for rigorous arguments in all walks of life. That's the point about his critique on science. Yes, we can critique science, but you'd have to be an absolute fool not to use science in your life. Only a mad person would want to conduct his or her life with complete Spock-like logicality. We are possessed, and here's the main point, not of minds alone, but of hearts, emotions, needs, instincts, and habits. And we inhabit social context. So, what I want to suggest is that putting all this back into the bigger picture of what we're doing here. We started off with different angles to getting to simple, pure, almost childish, youthful faith. And we pointed out that what happens to many of us as we grow older is we become more sophisticated, which is obviously a positive thing. We become more skeptical, perhaps. We become more thinking, more questioning, more analytical. And all of those things start to come and infiltrate our pure, natural, simple faith. And then that starts to waver, that starts to dissipate, we start to lose, that starts to slip. And what I'm suggesting that we do in order to recapture that faith is push back on the amount of space within our life experience that the questioning part of ourselves occupies. I think that for many of us, the questioning part of ourselves occupies a huge amount of our space, of our personality. And what I think we need to do is pull it back a little bit. Let it occupy what it needs to occupy, but open up space for other parts of ourselves, for other ways to experience the world. And I think this is actually a unique challenge to modern orthodoxy. There was an article written in the Jewish Week by someone named Elie Fischer titled Modern Orthodoxy Has Its Costs, Not Just Financial. And he writes that, if you look on page 3, on the top of page 3, the pressure to produce high earners discourages and marginalizes those members of the community whose calling is in music, literature, the visual arts, or the performing arts. The problem is not only that creative types will likely be unable to afford the modern Orthodox lifestyle. The community itself tends to marginalize those who pursue artistic careers, viewing them as irresponsible. Now, I'm by no means in any way, God forbid, trying to critique any parenting as a 26-year-old or anything like that, by any stretch of the imagination. But I think the point here is somewhat accurate in that our community, there's not that much space for more artistic types of expression, for more creative, outside the schooling, platform, outside of, you know, doing well and getting good grades in school, but really just being open to, expressing self and experiencing the world and going out into nature and being an artist and being a musician and being a poet and all these sort of more creative types, parts of ourselves that aren't the, I can get a good grade in school, I can get a good grade on a test. And that's why I think for our community in particular, really for everyone, but all, very much so for our community, there's this challenge of faith, because since we're so focused on, you know, doing well in school and getting certain types of jobs and leading a certain type of life, we are giving so much space, so much strength and power to that questioning part of ourselves. Because that questioning part is the part that does well in school. That questioning part of ourselves that might have seemed boring a little bit, but that's the part that does well in school. That's the part that performs and gets the good parent-teacher conferences and all that type of stuff. So it takes up so much space because that's the part that's empowered. and given privilege in this context. But what we need to do is open that up and allow for a more rich and wholesome experience of different parts of the world. So in our sort of journey of faith, we started off with a step towards God, sort of a step back because of the questions, and now what I want to do is recapture that simple faith. So just for 5 more minutes, and then we'll hopefully continue this next time. But for 5 minutes, or 6 minutes, I think I still have, I want to look at section D on page 3. And I want to talk about the idea of once we've been able to sort of push that questioning part aside a little bit, we can now move from the concept of experiencing faith as opposed to thinking about faith. And that's really the main upshot of this whole thing I'm trying to present. So that's really right here where it is. To move from thought to encounter. To feel and experience a relationship that is faith, a direct encounter. Not a thought, not a belief even, not an argument, not a proof, but something that is just a direct encounter. And if you remember last time, we saw in when we're looking at the angle of natural faith that we called the experience of nature. So we saw an article from a philosopher named Laura Garcia, who spoke about her experience living out in the mountains and out in nature. And she spoke about how by living and experiencing the beauty of the world, she came to faith. And she writes here a very, very important and amazing insight into that experience that she had. So on the first source after section D, she writes, "Some will see in this," referring to the argument we saw last week, of her description of her experience of the beauty of nature and that brought her to God. "Some will see in this nothing more than a short and unconvincing version of the design argument for God's existence." Meaning the argument that if there's a world, there must be a creator, every effect has a cause, some philosophical argument. So she's saying that some people are going to look at me, and when I say I experience God in the world, they're going to say to me, "You're making a philosophical argument that because you see a world, so then you must be that there's a creator, the creator must..." Okay, they're going to see that. But she says, "But that is not how I would describe it. Rather, it seemed to me as though I felt God's presence in the beauty of these natural wonders, that I was standing before him, their maker and their life. From the perspective of the believer, coming to God often seems more like an encounter than like solving a math problem." The point is that when you experience that beautiful world, then suddenly the part of your mind that questions jumps up and gets in your way and says, "Hold on, who said that's God? Who said that means there must be a God?" But her point is, hold on, why are we even building an argument out of it? I'm just experiencing something directly. This is a direct encounter with God. And Rav Soloveitchik, in Lonely Man of Faith, brings out the same point in even more strongly. He expresses it more fully. "The trouble," he writes, "with all rational demonstrations of the existence of God, with which the history of philosophy abounds, consists in their being exactly what they were meant to be by those who formulated them, abstract logical demonstrations divorced from the living primal experiences in which these demonstrations are rooted. For instance, the cosmic experience..." That's the experience of the beauty of nature and feeling God's presence, "was transformed into a cosmological proof." That's the whole argument, that if there's a world, there must be a God. Meaning we took that experience and we transformed it into a rational argument. But that's not what we should do. We should just live with the experience. And says Rav Soloveitchik, and this is the most beautiful thing, "Does the loving bride in the embrace of her beloved ask for proof that he is alive and real? Must the prayerful soul clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved demonstrate that he exists? When we experience God, that experience doesn't have to be translated into an argument. It doesn't have to enter under the scrutiny, the microscope, the test of our rational questioning minds. The experience is an experience. I'm experiencing being present with all of you right now. I don't have to start questioning that. When I experience God, I don't have to start questioning that. When I experience God, that is it. That's the relationship. Faith is the relationship. Faith is the encounter. It's not an argument. It's not a thought. It's an encounter." And I want to just read, and we'll close with this. I apologize that I'm reading so much, but it just happens to be that all these people are able to formulate and express these ideas so much better than I can. So I just feel that it would be a shame for you to experience it through my own words and not through their words. So Rabbi Lamb has two amazing quotes where he formulates exactly this idea, and with this we'll end in a couple of minutes. Rabbi Lamb writes in the bottom of page 3, "Martin Buber speaks of two types of faith. The name of one of his books is Two Types of Faith. One is a state of acknowledgement in which I accept with my whole being and not only my reason certain propositions as true. The other is a relationship of trust where, again, not necessarily with sufficient reason, I commit my confidence in another. For our purposes, let us sharpen that distinction. The first, if you didn't follow that until now, here we go. That of acknowledgement is a cognitive type of faith. It's something in your mind, in which I intellectually accept certain propositions as true, such as the existence and unity of God. This is a belief that type of faith, that God exists, that he is one, that he is incorporeal. The content of this faith is noetic. Its mode is intellectual. The second type, that of trust, is not belief that, but belief in. Regardless of the thoughts I entertain about God, regardless of my theology and dogmas I affirm, I believe in him, I trust and esteem him. This is the area not of propositions, but of relationship. It is not existential in the logician sense, but existential in the existentialist sense. It's a relationship. And finally, we'll close with one more thought. And this quote is going to bring us full circle. Because Rabbi Lamb here writes that we opened up, actually, in the beginning, with, again, this idea of simple faith. But the point here of simple faith doesn't mean simple faith in the negative context of simple, meaning that it's empty, that it's fluffy, that there's holes in it. When we say simple faith, it could be something extremely rich and something extremely profound. But the point is that it's a direct encounter. And that's exactly what Rabbi Lamb writes in this last quote on the back on page 4. Perhaps the most radical exponent of emunah tamima, which means wholesome and pure and simple belief and faith, in fairly modern times, was the Hasidic tzaddik, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. Yet one need but read his writings. Rabbi Nachman writes everywhere about, you have to have simple faith. Don't question, don't engage in philosophy, just simple, simple, simple faith. And maybe people get very turned off by that. But it's very interesting, because if you read other parts of Rabbi Nachman, Rabbi Lamb writes, and the writings about him by his leading disciple and biographer, to realize that he, Rabbi Nachman, was an extraordinarily complicated man. His biography is he was incredibly sophisticated, profound, almost tormented, is one of the books of biography about him. It's called Tormented Master. He was a profound person, complex person, who had suffered the worst torments of doubt, who had studied Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed, Manavuchim, and who had struggled valiantly in order to achieve the blessed Temimut, which he recommended over the theological sophistication for which he had such contempt. Simple faith is not the same as simple-mindedness. And the point here to bring this all full circle is that I think we can recapture that youthful simple faith when we open ourselves up to be able to experience a more wholesome experience of the world, in which we don't have to engage in questions, but we could have that craving, that desire for meaning, for purpose that brings us to God, that we can look at the world and not question how it came into existence, but just experience the presence of God in the beauty of the world. And we can go with our gut, with the gut that says there must be a God, the gut that experiences God, that feels touched by God, that when we're in prayer, we don't have to question. When we're in prayer, if we're experiencing a moment of connection in prayer, that is it, that's faith, that's relationship. That's not something which has to go under a microscope, but that is it right there. That's the end of the story, which is really the beginning of the story. But that's the whole point right there. That's the relationship, the move from thought to relationship, into experience, into an encounter, not an argument. So what I want to do next time is sort of now make the move to say, where does what we know as Judaism, mitzvos, the life of halacha and mitzvos, come into this? This is really nice. It sounds very inspirational, very meaningful. We have this simple faith which we can engage in, we can experience, we can be inspired, this beautiful world. But now, how does this come onto a day-to-day basis? And what are all these mitzvos, these halachas, which often seem very, very annoying and don't seem to fit into this type of faith? Where does that come into play? What I want to suggest, and hopefully God willing next time, is that mitzvos are exactly the way to capture this inspiration of faith and bring it into a daily experience of meaning. And not just be something which we could talk about for an hour in poetic words, but actually be something that we can live on a daily basis. And halacha and mitzvos gives us that opportunity to find that meaning, that simple faith, in moments throughout our day. So hopefully, God willing, next time we'll look at that. Thank you all so much again. Thank you to the audience.
Thank you.